Sometimes when Jesus spoke, he spoke words that were uplifting, encouraging, words of love and words of tenderness. I have a lot of that in the New Testament, in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And then sometimes Jesus spoke words that were just bone-chilling, because they were words of rebuke, words that were intended to shake people, words that were intended to alarm people. And these are the words that are found in our text this morning from Matthew chapter 11, and then in Matthew chapter 12. Let's read those verses, please. Then he began to denounce the cities in which most of his miracles were done, because they did not repent. Woe to you, Chorazin! Woe to you, Bethsaida! For if the miracles had occurred in Tyre and Sidon, which occurred in you, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. Nevertheless, I'll say to you, it will be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon in the day of judgment than for you. And you, Capernaum, will not be exalted to heaven, will you? You will descend to Hades. For if the miracles had occurred in Sodom, which occurred in you, it would have remained to this day. Nevertheless, I say to you that it will be more tolerable for the land of Sodom in the day of judgment than for you. In Matthew 12, Jesus continues to make statements along this same line. The men of Nineveh will stand up with this generation at the judgment and will condemn it, because they repented at the preaching of Jonah. And behold, someone greater than Jonah is here. The queen of the south, which was the queen of Sheba, the queen of the south will rise up with this generation at the judgment and will condemn it, because she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And behold, something greater than Solomon is here. I didn't ask Walker to lead that song that we sang a moment ago about a great day coming, but it certainly fits with these verses. These verses are talking about the day of judgment. And these verses are saying that there are going to be some people on the day of judgment which will lose their souls because they failed to avail themselves of opportunities, and they failed to do things that were right. And because of that, their souls will be lost. And he goes on to say in Matthew chapter 12 that there were going to be, as it were — I don't believe the words of Jesus here are necessarily literal, but Jesus said there in Matthew 12 that there would be people in the day of judgment that would rise up, so to speak, and condemn certain people because of things that they did not do that they should have done. They offered excuses, had opportunities, but begged off. We see this in Matthew chapter 25. Excuse making. Can't do this, can't do that. Opportunities to do this, opportunities to do that. But failed all along. Jesus said, on the day of judgment, that's going to come back to haunt you. And your soul will be lost eternally, because you fail to avail yourself of opportunities. And there will be people, and here's where I want to spend some time this morning, there will be people who are going to rise up in the judgment and condemn you because of your present day failures. As I get older and my time grows nearer to the day of judgment, I think about these verses and I wonder who is going to rise up in the judgment and rebuke me. You ever ask yourself that question based upon these verses that we read? Who's going to, as Jesus said, will take place? Who's going to rise up in the day of judgment and administer a rebuke to me because of my failures now? Because of excuses I make now? Things that I don't do now that I should do, I beg off and don't do them. There's a whole list of people that we could go through. I've got a relatively short list of possible people who will rise up in judgment and condemn me because of things I've failed to do, excuses I've made for not being as diligent in the work of God as I should have been. I want to go back. Let's just begin with one of my favorite Old Testament characters. We don't talk about him a whole lot, and he deserves a whole lot more attention than we sometimes give him. Let me see if you can figure out who he is. He became king when he was 8 years old. And he died when he was 39. Remember who that king was? 8-year-old king. And 31 years after he became king, he died. That was Josiah. And among the kings of Judah, there was nobody greater as a king than Josiah, except his great-grandfather. His great-grandfather was Hezekiah. And those were the two that were the greatest standouts as kings in the kingdom of Judah. But you know, you go back and you acquaint yourself with the life of Josiah. You take a look at his ancestry. His daddy and his granddaddy were two of the worst kings that Judah ever had. Amon was his father, and Manasseh was his grandfather. They were as wicked could be. They were idolatrous. They were murderous. They were as ungodly and unspiritual as they could be as kings and as men. Now, what does this have to do with Josiah? Okay, here's an 8-year-old boy who becomes king. And as he grows and matures as a person and as king, Josiah could have done what a lot of people do today. Oh, you have no idea how I was raised. My mom and dad were not good people. Even my grandparents, they were horrible people. They were wicked. They were vile. They were not religious people, not spiritual people at all. So that's just kind of my background, and not much I can do about it. And basically blame the way I was raised for the way I am now. it might be if when I stand before God in judgment and I give God that sorry excuse. I was just raised badly. Had a bad environment. Dysfunctional, all that stuff. But God could look at it and say, Josiah, would you mind coming up to the front here, please? Josiah, would you mind telling this person some things about yourself? And so Josiah is going to say, yeah, I became king when I was 8, and my dad and my granddad were horrible. They were miserable people. But then Josiah is going to say, but you know, if you look back at the 31 years that I was king and died when I was 39, I was a kid when I died, really, at 39. Not old at all. Josiah might say, you know, go back and take a look at what I did. And we find all of this in 2 Kings chapter 22, beginning. You might one of these days go back and acquaint yourself with Josiah. Go back to 2 Kings chapter 22 and start reading. And you're going to find out at least 4 things about Josiah. That in the 31 years that he was king, in spite of his bad daddy, in spite of his horrible grandfather, Josiah did not use that as an excuse. He rose above it. And he abolished idolatry. Perhaps that was the first and greatest achievement of Josiah. He got rid of idolatry in the land. At the time that Josiah died, 31 years later, basically idolatry was non-existent. Josiah took care of that. He understood what God's attitude was toward idolatry, and he set about at a really, really young age to get rid of it. And he succeeded. For many, many years in the land of Judah, the national observance of the Passover had ceased to exist. This was the great memorial of the people coming out of Egypt, crossing the Red Sea, going into Canaan, taking the land. But the night on which all of this got started, when God passed over the land, not a death angel, but when God passed over the land, and the firstborn died, they didn't have the blood over the house. That was to be memorialized forever. And the Jews had quit it. They were non-spiritual, giving themselves over to idols. Josiah remembered that. And Josiah set about to restore, and he accomplished the observance again of the Passover in the land of Canaan. The temple had fallen into a state of disrepair. The house of God, the holy place, the most holy place, all of that, where the center of things religious and spiritual occurred among the Jews. The temple had fallen into a state of disrepair, and the people did not care. They did not care, and Josiah did. At the reading of the law, remember Josiah tore his garments. He realized their great failures, and he set about to restore and to repair the house of God, and he did it. Basically, what Josiah did was to reverse 57 years of ungodliness among the Jews. His father had reigned 2 years and been wicked. His grandfather had reigned 55 years and been wicked. 57 years, the people had turned their back on God. And Josiah, in spite of having an upbringing that was not good, and having a heritage that was not good except for his great-grandfather Hezekiah, Josiah decided, I'm going to rise above all of this. I'm not going to be like my daddy. I'm not going to be like my granddaddy. I've got a choice to make, and I choose to be like my great-grandfather. You don't have to be weighted down and burdened down just because mom and dad weren't spiritually minded. And you weren't raised in a family that went to church or whatever, however you want to phrase that. You can't use that as an excuse because Josiah, from the time he was 8 until the time he was 39, will not let you do it. And Josiah will likely be one of those people that will rise up in judgment and say, shame on you. I rose above my upbringing. You should have. Joseph. Joseph is one of those who I think might rise up in judgment and condemnation. Ecclesiastes chapters 11 and 12 teach me that young people will be held accountable for the way they act as young people. The latter part of Ecclesiastes chapter 11. That's the reason chapter 12 verse 1 says, remember now your creators in the days of your youth. But young people, and sometimes I'm afraid that parents and grandparents may contribute to this. Young people say, you have no idea what it's like to be a teenager now. You have no idea the pressures, the peer pressure, the immorality, all of the ungodly stuff that is around us. The kids I hang around with, school where I go, entertainment, everything is so ungodly. And I'm tempted to do this, and it is just, it's just unbearable. And Joseph may stand up without having God call him up and say, hey, let me tell you a story. And this story is found in Genesis chapter 39, in the first 18 verses. Joseph was a young man. We don't know how old he was. Late teens, early 20s at the most, probably. When he was sold into Egyptian slavery, basically, and eventually wound up in the house of Potiphar, and was put in charge of this high Egyptian official's house. Everything was under Joseph's control. He was so highly thought of by Potiphar. Potiphar had an immoral wife, and she saw this young man. And I'm paraphrasing a lot, but the paraphrase is, I believe, accurate. Potiphar's wife saw this young man day after day after day. Good-looking guy, evidently. And she kept on and kept on and kept on coming on to him. She wanted Joseph and her to have an affair, to have sex with one another. Now, here's a young man in his late teens, early 20s. He's normal. Here was a woman. She was available. She said nobody will find out. Finally, she became aggressive to the point that she grabbed hold of him. And Joseph took off, ran out of the house. Joseph will tell young people in the day of judgment, that's what happened to me. You think that was easy to turn down? You think that was an easy thing to walk away from? I could have had all the fun I wanted to. It was there. And maybe we wouldn't have been caught. I don't know. But I took the high road. I ran. And I got out of there. So Joseph will say to young people, no. Don't give me this, it's just too powerful, you don't understand excuse. I've been there. I was there. And I left. I turned my back on it. I remained pure and righteous You could have done the same thing yourself, but you didn't. Young people, when the temptations become strong, and I'm not saying that you don't have strong temptations. I'm in sympathy with that. I'm not saying that they don't exist. What I'm saying is there is no excuse you can offer to engage in whatever the conduct is that's inappropriate. Among others, Joseph will not let you do it. Then there's somebody else. And we usually use this man as an example to young people, and we can and we should, and have no problem with that. This is Daniel. And Daniel was about the same age as Joseph was when he went into Babylonian captivity. Late teens, early 20s at the oldest. And he and his three friends that we're told about there in Daniel 1, and there were others of that in that age range, we're just told about those four. And as young people, they did some great things in Babylon. But I don't want to talk about that. There's a verse in Daniel chapter 1 that we don't spend too much time on. We kind of ignore this verse, and I think it's one that we need to look at. This is the Daniel 1 verse 21, the last verse. And Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king. Daniel continued. Now, what does that mean? Well, he continued in captivity until the first year of Cyrus the king. It could mean that, and I think it does. It could mean that Daniel continued in his good service to the Babylonian king for 70 years. I think that's proper. It could mean that after all the Jews went home from Babylonian captivity, that Daniel stayed, evidently. And he continued in his service to the Persian king. 70 years plus. Now, if Daniel was in his late teens, early 20s, and Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king, that means that Daniel was around 90 years old when we read about Daniel in the lion's den. This is not a kid. That's an old man in the lion's den. Now, here's the point that I want to make with Daniel. When I get to a certain age, and I don't know, perhaps I'm already there. Nobody just told me yet. But we get to a certain age in our life. We call it old age. I don't like that term, but that's what we use. And we feel like we'll back off. We've served God, okay? Now it's time, I've heard people say, yeah, it's time for the young kids to come along and do the things that I've done for the last 40, 50, 60 years. Really? Can you imagine Daniel saying that? Can you imagine Daniel telling a Babylonian king or a Persian ruler, okay, serve my time, ready to retire, turn it over to the people that follow me? I can't imagine that. And that's why I cannot imagine why people today, when they hit retirement age, whatever that age is for them, that they decide, I've taught enough classes, I've preached enough sermons, I've done a whole lot in my life, and now, in our last years, our golden years will be spent. We're going to hit the road and just have fun. Well, you got no problem with hitting the road and having fun. That's within reason. But to chunk it all in and to say, now that I'm older, I'm just basically going to quit. On the day of judgment, it could be that old Daniel totters up to the front of the line and said, shame on you. I continued for 70 years until the first year of Cyrus the king. Why didn't you do it? Now, very quickly, let me say, I understand, and I'm coming to understand it more and more every day. I understand that there comes a time in a person's life when physical things, mental things, limit what we can do. And we may not be as productive and active as we once were and would like still to be because of those things. I understand that. And I'm not trying to place unrealistic responsibilities upon those who are advanced in years. But whenever we are in good health, and at the magical age of 65 or 70 to decide, that's it. Now we're going to have fun until we die. Can't imagine that. And I'm afraid that Daniel is going to be one of those people who says, should have never done it. I was 90 plus years old, and I was still going strong in the service of God. In the New Testament, in Mark chapter 12, I read about somebody else who might just rise up in judgment against me. Mark 12, verse 41, and he, that's Jesus, he sat down opposite the treasury and began observing how the people were putting money into the treasury and how many rich people were putting in large sums. A poor widow came and put in 2 small copper coins, which amount to a cent. Calling his disciples to him, he said to them, truly I say to you, this poor widow put in more than all the contributors to the treasury. For they all put in out of their surplus, but she out of her poverty. She put in all she owned, all she had to live on. When it comes to the, I'm not talking now so much about the giving of money. That would be covered by this, but I'm not talking primarily about that. When it comes to this matter of giving ourselves, giving our talents, and Walker touched upon this in some comments he made a moment ago. Being contributors, not, as I said, money-wise, but talent-wise, time-wise, and other ways. You're doing the very best you can do, giving everything that you can give for the cause of Jesus. I see people, and this bothers me, I see people who, what little I know about their jobs, it's obvious they are very, very successful. I'm talking about from a monetary standpoint, but from the use of their talents and their abilities, they are the very best that they can be. Promotion, promotion, promotion. Commendation, commendation, commendation. That's great. But when it comes to the service of the Lord, I sometimes wonder if they were as diligent on their job in using their talents as they are among the people of God, those promotions and commendations would not be forthcoming. And this poor little widow will rise up in judgment against those of us today who didn't give it all, who gave only a pittance of what we could have given, monetarily-wise, talent-wise, time-wise. And that little widow will condemn us. So many other people to talk about. Use just one more, and then we'll quit. Timothy. I think Timothy will be someone who may rise up in judgment against people today. I take a look at Timothy, and he picks up with Paul on his preaching tours. Paul baptizes him, and he becomes a son to Paul. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul details so many bad things that had happened to him in his life as a preacher and apostle. Timothy saw all of that. Timothy saw all the hypocrites in the church. He saw all the division in Corinth. He saw all the bad things that Christians could do to other Christians. He saw all of that. And Timothy could have done what I've heard people today do and say, well, I tell you what, I've seen all these hypocrites in the church, and I've seen all this church fight and church division, and I don't want any part of it. I'll just stay home on Sunday. Timothy could have done that. In fact, Timothy could have said, I've seen things, you have no idea what I've seen. I saw stuff happen to Paul that would cause you to blush. But it didn't stop me. And it shouldn't have stopped you. I don't care how many hypocrites you've seen. I don't know how much trouble in the church you've seen. You could have seen a lot. I have when I was a kid. But Timothy will not let us use that as an excuse to not serve God. I'm going to take the Lord's Supper here in just a moment, and I want to remind you of something in Acts chapter 20. Something that that Paul did. As he was working his way toward Jerusalem, he was in a hurry to get to Jerusalem. A real big hurry. But when he got to Troas, he stopped for a week. Do you remember what the context of Acts chapter 20 indicates as a possible reason for why Paul, on this really, really rushed trip to Jerusalem, why would he stop for an entire week in Troas? Why? To partake of the Lord's Supper. That's how much it meant to Paul. Does it mean that much to you? On the day of judgment, when you're called to account for your failure to assemble with saints on the first day of the week and observe the death of Jesus, you think Paul might be one who comes up and says, look, I was on a trip one time, really in a big rush to get somewhere, but I waited an entire week with some brethren in a town just so we could eat the Lord's Supper together. Does that mean that much to you? If it doesn't, Paul might be one of these people who rises up in judgment and condemns us. But for now, our attention is focused upon what Paul's attention was focused on. In Acts chapter 20, that high priest that we have who gave himself as a one-time offering for sin. And every week we remember that as we partake of what we call the Lord's Supper. Let's stand to sing a song, prepare our minds for that.